Welcome to episode 4 of Coral's Soapbox. Good morning, Coral Druin. Welcome.
Good morning, Matt. How are you?
I am well. How is things on the Gold Coast?
Actually, it's been very nice. Yesterday was rainy, but up until then, because my pool, oh dear, that sounds so bourgeois, doesn't it? My pool is heated, so I was in swimming the day before yesterday.
And do you have someone that comes and cleans the pool as well? Or
we do have someone who comes and cleans the pool, yes, but not enough for me to be a cougar. Very ordinary pool cleaning man, but he does a good job.
Now, I did put up a post on Facebook the other day just explaining what Coral's Soapbox is about, because
I put up one too.
Some fans have been getting upset that we're not dedicating everything to Prisoner, and we do have to let them know it's not all dedicated to Prisoner.
No, not at all. Yeah. Not at all. That's why it's got a different title.
Called Soapbox.
And, yeah.
You've worked on a lot of other shows, so we are going to cover a lot of other shows. Today we're going to cover baddies from Prisoner, but before we do, any news of the day? Is there any news that you would like to talk about?
Gosh, not news per se, except that Trump is back in the news again. And I would have loved to have, I mean, you could not write a character like Donald Trump. You just couldn't. I mean, if we put him in Prisoner, people would have said that character is completely unbelievable. Yes. You know, you can't expect the audience to believe that one person would do so many bad things. So, but I find him quite entertaining, but I do fear for the world, quite frankly, with him at the helm of it. If he gets back in again, I'm going to be on the first spaceship to Mars. I'm telling you, that's definitely it. I do want to say, I know there are some characters that people want me to talk about, and I don't remember them really well. And when I originally when you said to me, let's talk about characters that you created, and I hastily put together a list of 40 characters. Since then, going through it, I have discovered that there are over 200 characters that I created for Prisoner. And so all I can say to people is, as a general rule, every character from episode 300, though there were some I created before that, but every character from episode 300 through to 600, I created. So if it's someone who appeared in that time, I may not remember them because, you know, there were over 200 of them and some of them were not in for very long. Yeah. But if they're in that period, they're mine. If they're not in that period and I had nothing to do with creating them, then I don't want to comment too much on them. I mean, somebody has made comments that, I knocked or I dissed the writing of the earlier characters. And I have made the point that I had nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
Nothing whatsoever. Do I think that my characters were more rounded, more developed? Yeah, of course I do. I've got an ego.
But the show was more developed by then anyway. I mean,
the show was far more developed and it was a very different show. People who say, oh, I never watched it after Vera Bennett left or, fair enough. But it did become a very different show and shows have to evolve. Now, people have a right to like them or not like them, depending on, you know, what their thing is. But it is a different show. And so I don't want, and I do excuse the fact that those early characters were not that well developed because it was only expected to run 16 episodes.
And like you said, there was no Bible. You said there was no Bible when you started.
There was no Bible. No, there was no Bible. There were no character notes except a couple of lines. And there was no Bible. There were no future projections. There were no future stories. It was, you know, we hadn't done a 2 hour a week show like that ever before in Australia, never. And because of that, it was very much make it up as you go along. And somebody criticized this week the fact on Facebook that we didn't do any proper HIV or AIDS stories, which I had to slap them heavily on the wrist for, because, and it does piss me off a little bit, I don't want to pick out any particular fans, but most of the people who love us and adore us and still watch us didn't get to see this show until the late 1980s or the 90s. The show wrapped up in the mid 1980s, and we didn't do any prisoner gay story, or what, well, not gay stories, but AIDS stories, because it wasn't a big thing. Even at its peak in 1994 in Australia, when it was absolute, oh my God, it's AIDS, it's everywhere. Guess how many cases there were?
How many?
You know? No. 900 cases out of 25 million people.
Wow.
So it was not a huge thing in Australia.
Yeah.
And I think the fans do need to remember, especially if they're seeing the show long after we made it, we never thought the show would be a worldwide phenomenon. We never, ever. It just wasn't on our radar. You know, it was not sold to England until I think we finished, or we were shooting the last few episodes when they started showing it. So when we were actually making it, it was for an Australian audience only. It wasn't for an international audience. And I think I told you, I went to Hong Kong in the 90s, and Hong Kong was showing it dubbed into Chinese. And they were showing the early episodes, and Bean was going, and I apologize to all the Chinese people watching, but I don't speak Chinese. That's a little bit how it sounds.
Like a Bruce Lee movie.
Like a Bruce Lee movie. It was like a Bruce Lee movie. Absolutely hysterical. And I've subsequently seen it dubbed into Spanish. I've seen it dubbed into German, and it still works. I mean, it works, but it does, to our ear, it sounds really strange. And I suppose I should be really grateful that the English understood, the Brits understood the Australian accent and didn't dub us for Britain. Otherwise, the one thing is you couldn't have made Erica sound any more British if you tried to. You know, how could you make it? But we might have had me saying, I say, old bean, I don't think you should do that, or I might have to put your hand in the press.
Yeah.
So we're very lucky in that respect. But please do remember the show finished in the mid-80s. There were lots of things that I wish we'd continued longer so we could have covered. But
when you speak of the AIDS pandemic, I mean, I remember as I was a kid in the 80s, that ad that they made. Remember that ad with the
Grim Reaper one?
Grim Reaper, my God.
Yes.
Like, what is it? We had, you know, we're kids.
We had no idea. And that was supposed to frighten everybody into not having sex. Wrong. Well, it may have frightened you, Matt, because you were young enough to say, no, I'm not going there.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. Sorry.
But no, it wasn't a big thing. And the comments were about Gay Ray how, you know, he was a caricature of a gay person. Well, back in the 80s, there were a lot of gay people who, specifically to make the point, were flamboyant queens. They overplayed their homosexuality because they wanted to get in the faces of those people who were so judgmental. I mean, now they don't have to, because it's a very different world. But there are still over-the-top flamboyant queens. You know, I met one only last week, and I thought, oh my God, I didn't know such people still existed. But it was a very different world, very, very different world. And that's why some of it looks quaint and very old-fashioned. It's 40 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. Before we start, what are your thoughts on... Actually, I noticed Jan Russ put a post up yesterday about Shane Crawford getting a part on Joseph.
I'm with her all the way. There are... and we should explain to British viewers that Shane Crawford is a footballer.
Yes.
He's not an actor. He's not a recording artist. He's not really anyone who's going to put bums on seats. I wouldn't have thought, but obviously the producers think so. And it's quite appalling given how many really good actors we have out of work that a role would go to, even though if you know Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat, it's not a huge role, the role of the Pharaoh, but it doesn't matter. It should be going to an actor. It should not be going to a footballer. How would the footballers feel if all of the equity actors, equity members suddenly decided to invade the football pitches? You know, I'm not saying that if he wants to be an actor, he shouldn't go to acting school and then audition like anybody else. And if he's the best, then he gets the role. But to just cast a footballer in a role which is meant for an actor is just appalling. It really is just appalling. And I know there'll be people who hate me for saying that, just as the pro Roe versus Wade ban people had a go at me for that.
People are saying you and I belong together, that we should be married.
Darling, I think you're about 10 years younger than my youngest daughter. What are you, about 40?
If I was single, I would, so it's all good. But going back on Shane Crawford just quickly, in his defence, he's a great guy and a champion footballer. And, you know, he has done TV since.
Absolutely. And he had to promote. And I don't assign any blame to him whatsoever.
Yeah. But you're right. Whatsoever. It's such a small pool in Australia that a lot of actors that are out of work.
There are not that many professional productions. And in fact, just to keep their hand in, a lot of professional actors go and do community theatre shows for nothing, just because it's a role they would like to play, or because they haven't had a show for about 12 months or longer, and they want to keep their skills up. And some of the community theatre productions are extraordinarily high, really, really high. Anyone down in Victoria must go and see any PLOS production or any Clock production, because they're absolutely brilliant. Yeah. In Sydney, I think it's Marrickville that does really good musicals, etc. But, you know, there are professional actors who could play the role of Pharaoh.
Yeah.
And it is not fair to bring in a footballer to play that role when there are actors who could play it. Now, that doesn't mean that I am going the politically correct route, because I'm not. Right. We've had a situation here, in Australia for quite a while, where diversity is under attack. And there is a whole group of people that think, for example, if you're going to do Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, then you must have two drag queens play two drag queens, and you must have a transgender person play the transgender person. And my argument would always be the best person for the role. By all means, everybody should have access to auditioning. Everybody should have access to reach their potential. They should have access to training. But the best person should still get the role. I mean,
with a transgender person, do you think they should get a transgender role, or that's open to everyone?
It should be open to everyone. We don't say. I actually did an interview with the young actor who is playing the prince in Cinderella, the current production of Cinderella. And he said, I would never say that we have to, only a gay person can only play a gay person. It's ridiculous. It's called acting. And in fact, he's made his name playing straight, heroic type males, heterosexual males. And he's openly gay. And he should be able to play gay roles, straight roles, pink with purple polka dot roles if he chooses to, if he is the best person to play the role. And in fact, the role of the transgender person in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert has been played on Broadway and here a lot by Tony Sheldon, who is the son of Tony LeMond, who is a truly wonderful actor, singer. He has also played the gay character in Torch Song Trilogy, but he's also played Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha. He's also been in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. And he's just a fabulous actor. Whereas the new production of Priscilla cast a transgender, very fine transgender cabaret performer, but had never done a musical show before and is quite swamped by it. She is not the best person to be playing that role. And so it's worked against the idea of diversification. If you say yes, like affirmative action in America said, you must have a certain amount of African Americans in jobs to fill quotas. Well, I'm about excellence. I'm not about quotas. I'm about, by all means, let's look at everybody. Let's, you know, if someone comes along, then who is great, let's have them, no matter what. I mean, I don't see any reason. If I could have had Deborah Mailman, I wouldn't have written in an Indigenous role for her. I would just have said, okay, Deborah Mailman is going to play Judy Bryant because she's the best person there is for it. And if she had been around at the time, she probably would have been. She would have been absolutely brilliant for it. Yeah. But, you know, the idea that you can't do The King and I anymore, the musical The King and I anymore, unless you cast an Asian as the king and Asians as all the children. Now, that's absolute bullshit. Anyone who's seen the film of The King and I who thinks that Yul Brynner is Asian is off their rockers, because he's not.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's synonymous with that role. So I do not believe in people blacking up. I mean, when I was a kid, we had a show in England, and some of the viewers will remember it, called The Black and White Minstrels. And it was based on the reviews, the old-time Mississippi showboat reviews, where white entertainers did put on blackface and white lips and winks. Really? And yeah, I mean, no, you shouldn't do that now because it's offensive to an awful lot of people. But the idea that a transgender person has to play a transgender person, I think is ridiculous. They should have the chance to play a transgender person. They should have the opportunity to audition for it. And if someone looks at them and says, oh, wow, they are really great, and they understand things about the character which a non-transgender person could never understand, then, of course, we need to have them. But that's because they're best for the role. Who wants to be put in a role simply because you're a token rather than because of your talent?
Talent, definitely.
So, yes, I agree with Jan Rus. And if people in England don't know what we're talking about, it's simply that Jan Rus came out and said that role should go to an actor. It should not go to a footballer. And I agree with her entirely.
Awesome.
Now, can we get on to Prisoner before people start slagging off at me again?
Because they slag off at me. They got off at me.
No, they do it. Matt can't keep her on subject.
You are on subject. This is the subject. We go off topic. Just two more things before we do start. Two shows I want to quickly ask you about that I watched recently. The Lincoln Lawyer. Are you watching that? New David
I have watched it, yes.
Yeah, great show.
I don't think it's his best work.
No.
I don't think, I you know I'm a fan, but yeah. I don't think it's his best work. I think it's good,
yeah.
But I don't know that it's, he's lost his edge, I think, a little bit. What's the other one?
Trainwreck on Netflix, a documentary on the Woodstock 99 concert.
Oh, God, no, I've still, it's on my watch list.
Oh, my God.
It's on my watch list, but I can imagine that will be fantastic. I can heartily recommend, and I recommend it to some people in England. It's just starting in Britain now, and I know we have a lot of British fans.
Yes.
I can heartily recommend one of Australia's top series, which is just starting, started last week, I think, in Britain, The Newsreader,
yes,
which is absolutely amazing. Terrific. Television. I can heartily recommend, and it's got the lovely Deborah Mailman and some wonderful Indigenous actors in it, and Wayne Blair directing many of them. And I can heartily recommend Total Control, which is an Australian political drama series, which is brilliant. And I can also heartily recommend an Italian series called Devils. Which the first series is the global financial disaster in 2008 to 2011. The second series is about the whole of the data wars and China trying to take over the world. So it actually uses real footage and then goes behind the scenes and explores how the Chinese manipulated this, how the yes vote for Brexit was manipulated completely. Oh, wow. Through. It's fascinating, but it is a drama series with drama, proper dramatic stories. And that's also, is that? I'm not sure if it's Netflix or if it's SBS On Demand, Matt, but okay. I think you probably like that because it's got a lot of good stuff in it.
But let's talk about Trainwreck next episode because it was fantastic.
Okay.
It was.
That means I've got to watch it.
What? Three
episodes? I was going to have my free month trial on Stan and watch a couple of things on that I haven't seen. So, but yeah. Okay, I'll watch Trainwreck.
Netflix is bringing some really good things out. I watched a thing on it was about swatting the other day. I never heard of it. It was about a gamer, true story, that would he got frustrated with people that bet him online, so he would ring up and say to the SWAT team in America, oh, there's a bomb at that house.
Yes, I saw that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it?
But the carnage he caused. The
I know.
And the police
killed truth him. Is always stranger than fiction. When we have people say, oh, that story is not believable, truth is always stranger than fiction. And on almost everything you do, you can find out that it's actually happened in life, even when you think you've made it up. When you think, oh, but I made that up. That would never happen. I made it up. And then you find out, yeah, it happened.
It happened.
Absolutely.
All right. Episode 472, which was first seen on the 26th of July, 1984, on the back of Mari Winter escaping on the famous helicopter, we see the introduction of Bev Baker for six episodes only, played by Maggie Dentz. Now, you told me a very personal story on the phone about why you created this character or why it got so dark.
What did I tell you on the phone? Because I can't remember.
Well, there was things going on in your personal life.
There were lots of things going on in my personal life at that stage. I think I had just had my 40th birthday, on which I had got pregnant. And having got pregnant, my partner at the time, and we were together 20 years, but he was bipolar, and he just said, you know, I can't be a father. I don't know. You know, he freaked out. He almost had a breakdown. So I had an abortion. I had a termination of that pregnancy. I was having problems with my youngest daughter, who was in her teens. And we're both Librans. We're both very opinionated. We're both very smart. And we go like this. We managed to get through two nights together.
Is that Kelly?
But when we tried last holidays to make it three nights, everything blew up on the third night. And she actually ordered me out of my house. That'll tell you what sort of relationship. Get out, she said. Actually, she didn't. She said, fuck off. Out, get out. So, plus I was, although I didn't know it at the time, going into menopause, and so it was, you know, a really difficult time for me. But once again, you've destroyed my thought process, because I want to talk about what makes a baddie a baddie. Yep. As opposed to a psychopath. Now, Bev was a psychopath. David Bridges was a psychopath. Those people have no, that they are the center of their own little universe, and they have no concept of what other people think or feel. Now, psychopaths make great baddies, and most serial killers are psychopaths. But the problem is that you can't diverge from the fact that they're nutters, basically. Now, when we brought Bev Baker in, that character was actually inspired by a book that I read, 40, 50 years ago, called The First Deadly Sin, which was made into a movie. And I think Frank Sinatra starred as the detective, not as the killer. Oh, yeah. But the reason why they had so much trouble catching him, the killer, was because he killed for no reason. It was just thrill kills. Now, 40 odd years ago, that was something, I mean, we hear a lot about that now. We actually do hear a lot about it. People kill just to see what it's like to kill someone, which I find just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and some of those gangs in America, that's your initiation.
Your initiation. Go and kill someone. Kill a complete stranger, someone who hasn't done anything to you. It's a horrific thought. But I wanted something that was a bit more interesting than that. So I thought, what if this person looked like they were killing out of mercy? They were killing, you know, people who were going to die anyway. And they were mercy killings. And that fed into my belief that euthanasia should be legalized, as it is now being legalized. It's taken us a long, long time to treat humans the same way we treat sick animals, which is
legalized in Queensland yet?
I think the debate's still going on. I think it comes up for the vote in this of Parliament. Okay. But it will pass. I mean, the world has moved on. And really now, why, if someone wants, it's a bit like the same argument over abortion. It's a woman's body, and why should she be forced to carry something in it she doesn't want to, and or that she can't? And why should you be forced to live in agony if there is another way for you? And there are, you know, some, there is an idiot who a complete and utter idiot who posts in response to these podcasts. I'm not going to mention his name, but you know, he said on number two, he commented, why don't these women, you know, why don't these women get sterilized, or why don't they go on the pill and then they wouldn't have to have abortions? To which I replied, why don't men stop raping women? And why don't men stop refusing to take responsibility for birth control themselves? Those are generalizations. No, you know, they're just generalizations. So I wanted, when we brought Bev in, I wanted her to not seem instantly like a monster.
Yes.
I wanted people to think, oh, well, she's actually doing a good thing. There are all these sick people and she's helping them die. Until during the Lassa fever story, she actually corners the social worker and sticks a knitting needle right up under his rib cage and through his heart.
Yeah,
now I think scene, I'm sure
that scene was it was so scary. I watched it last night again, and she's cleaning that knitting needle with the blood. It was so detailed, like a mechanic checking a dipstick with the oil.
And I have to say that that's Maggie's brilliant acting in that role. But you have to remember that when we were storylining her and creating the scripts for her, we did not see her on screen. We had never seen her on screen. In fact, for the first 2 or 3 weeks that we were storylining that character, and the character was my creation, and I think it was a way of dealing with everything dark that was going on in my life at that time. It was like the world is fucked up and everyone sucks and, you know, what's the point? We may as well all walk around killing everybody. But we never saw her on screen, so we had no way of knowing how Maggie was going to play her. And that's what people don't realize when they've seen it. They say, oh, they should have done such and such. But there is this gap of about 3 to 4 months between storylining a character, and that's about 2 months after you create a character, and the character actually being in studio shooting. And then there is usually around 6 months before it goes to air. So if you look at that span right across the board, it's around 9 months. It really is like giving birth to a child. So
you don't see it until it's on air.
We see it before it's on air, but we don't see it till 3 months down the track, by which time we've done another 20-odd scripts.
Yeah.
So Maggie was already written out. Bev Baker was already written out before we even saw Maggie play her on screen.
Wow.
Now, if we had seen Maggie play her on screen, I might have said, oh, God, she's so good. Let's find a way to
that was
sort
my
of
question. Would you
flatten out some of the edges of this so that it's not so horrific? But we never saw her on screen. And by week six of, or week five, I think it was, of putting her into storylines, I suddenly had my male storylining team, because I had three guys as storyliners, making excuses for not coming into work. And when they got into work, saying, oh, I've just got to pop out for something, and taking very long toilet breaks. And the reason I found out was because she scared the living daylights out of me.
Oh, really?
She really did. And she made them feel quite ill. And the reason for that is, with a psychopath like Bev, you are powerless, because it doesn't depend on you whether you're nice to the person or whether they have some grievance against you. She didn't need a grievance against you. You could, as the young social worker was when he walked down the corridor, hello, I'm so-and-so, how are you? Straight up. And so that is what terrified them, was the stripping away of power. Now, we all know that, well, we should do by now. We've seen enough. I'm fascinated with serial killers.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated with the fact that serial killers don't look like serial killers. They look like perfectly ordinary, normal people. Otherwise, everyone would go, oh, serial killer, and point them out in the street. So I'm fascinated by how people can be totally psychopathic in their head, but to the outside world, they present as being perfectly normal. Now, Beth Baker came into prison. She could have been a sympathetic character. In fact, when she came in, she's killed all these people. But all these people were old people who were dying in hospital anyway. So you could think, she shouldn't be there. She's actually done a good thing. She's given them a painless death. But because we know that kind of psychopath strips away all your power, and men in particular like to feel that they have power. A certain degree of power, which is why, as we also know, psychologically, rape is not about sex, it's about power. It's about exerting power, making someone helpless so that you can do what you want. And so I had male storyliners in revolt because she was so revolting. And we did not know who had been cast. And I said to the guys, well, you know, this is a long-term character. And they all said, no, we're out of here. We're gone. And I finally said, you know what? She's got to go. Because the only thing we do when we come in here, we didn't come into story meetings anymore saying, oh, great, let's do something really. You know, we came in going, oh, the fuck, what's Bev going to do this week? And so to me, the trick was finding how you take her out, because she held all the power. And that was the other thing, is she could have killed any of those people, yeah. Any of them. But could any of them have killed her? And so that was when, you're looking absolutely fascinated at the moment, Matt.
It was a really fascinating character. I mean, even
it was a fascinating character, but when we came to say, okay, how's she going to go out? We said, well, we've got to close the door on her, so she's got to die. And we sat through a whole morning of brainstorming, trying to figure out, you know, who was going to kill her. I think Myra was top dog.
Because Myra went into Mrs. Reynolds and said, you got to get rid of her. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And you never saw a top dog do that.
Yeah, yeah, no, but, you know, Myra was trying to protect, you know, her own tribe, the other women prisoners. She knew that this woman didn't need a reason. And so we decided, after about 3 hours of brainstorming, every possible way of will Myra kill her, will this, I said, she's got to kill herself, because that's the ultimate high. You watch other people die, but you're still only experiencing it vicariously through them. But if you're really a thrill killer and you really want to get the thrill of watching someone die, what could be a bigger thrill than watching yourself die? So, of course, she injects herself with the air bubbles.
Does that really happen in real life?
Yeah, it's a real thing. It is a real thing. Wow. And also, you know, people said, oh, that wouldn't kill you. But yes, it will. If you inject enough air, then it will kill you. And the things you find out, I mean, I watch a lot of true crime series now, even though I'll never do another crime show. Yesterday, I found out, I don't know if I should even be telling you this, because there'll be a whole range of murders coming up. Yesterday, I found out that the main active ingredient in eye drops, Optrix, Visine, those things, right? If ingested in more than a drop, like if you put half a bottle of it in a glass of water, it's tasteless, it's odorless, it has no appearance, it's clear, it's deadly poison.
Oh, really?
It shuts down your immune system, or it shuts down your organs one by one, and your immune system, you can't fight it. and the result is death.
Wow.
And because what it does is it triggers heart failure as the last thing, the deaths are put down to heart attack. So unless you have a reason to think it's a murder, no one is going to go looking for it. And I found this in a true murder case yesterday. And the woman pleaded that she gave it to her husband because he'd been nasty to her. And a friend had told her that caused diarrhea, which it does. If you put one or two drops on your tongue, it causes diarrhea and you've got no control over your bladder or your bowels. But in larger amounts, and she put a whole bottle of Visine in a glass of water, it kills you. And the fact that she was a nurse, the court said she would have known that. She would have known that it was poisonous, and so she can't plead that. And she got 99 years in jail, this woman, for killing her husband. But yes, you can kill someone by injecting air into... So what you've got to do is pull the syringe back and fill the syringe with air and then stab it into a vein and push the button.
Jeez.
And that will go through your system, hit your heart, and cause a coronary embolism. And I did not realize how horrific it would be, nor did I realize how horrific she would appear on screen.
Yes.
But in our imaginations, she was even worse than she was on screen. And so she had to go. And that's why I think, how many episodes did she do, Matt?
I did six.
Just six episodes.
Yeah.
So 3 weeks, basically.
Yeah.
So two hours a week.
And not to take you off topic, but... when you say you didn't see her on screen and things like that, and obviously that was for the whole show, and we all know in America, most shows, the writers, producers, everyone is in there. Writers are watching the show be made. That didn't happen in Australia at that time.
It did not happen in Australia. In fact, I think that Blue Heelers, round about 95, 96, started to have a read-through, which American shows have had for 20, 30, 40 years. And at the read-through, the characters and the writers are there at the read-through, and the producer is there and the director is there. And you get to say, oh, well, we can't shoot that scene that way. And so the script producer will say, okay, we'll move the location, and we'll say to the writer, change those lines to that and that and that, and you find out what works and what doesn't work. The reality was that when we were scripting Prisoner, here was the process, okay? And this is Prisoner, folks, so I'm not changing the subject. We would go in on a Monday morning, and it would be block whatever it was. So block whatever it was would go to air as 2 hours a week. In Australia, it was on a Monday and a Thursday night originally at 8:30. Now, although that was 2 one-hour episodes, as a block, it was 4 half-hour episodes. Now, the reason for doing that is if it ever got to the point, and remember that Neighbours didn't start until I think it was the last year but one of Prisoner. But there was a lot of muttering about serials, half-hour strips, we call them. You strip it across 5 nights a week or 4 nights a week. So in the event that the channels ever move to strips, which was Neighbours and Home and Away, then we could say, well, we're already blocking it that way. So you will always find in Prisoner that there is a mini cliffhanger at the third commercial break. That's because that's where A of block one would have finished, the first episode. And sometimes when you see two writers credited for an episode, it is because one of them wrote the first half, episode A of block one, and someone else wrote B.
Yep.
So that That is the reason for that. We would come in on Monday morning and we would have that week. So we would have Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday to come up with all of the stories for that week, which is probably in excess of 85, 90 scenes with three stories. There were always three stories running across an episode, except when I decided to break the mold and we'd do the odd one, which was one story all the way through. But we would have 4 days in which to come up with the overall arc for 2 hours and then break that down into 4 half-hour episodes, which would be 1 and 2 blocked together and 3 and 4 blocked together.
Yep.
4 days, 4 working days to do that. On day 5, we would then write the scene breakdowns. Now, a scene breakdown is everything that's in the scene, bar the dialogue, even to the heading telling you where the scene is to be held, and then underneath, for the purposes of the writer and the producers and the directors, who is in that scene. So it might say Judy Bryant, B. Smith, three NS extras, 2 50-worders. Now, a 50-worder is someone who can't say more than 50 words in an episode. An extra is a non-speaking person. That would then get broken down into scene breakdowns. All the writers had to do at that stage was put their own personal spin on the scene within the context of what we had written without following it by just putting inverted commas and the dialogue. So finding the characters' voices, finding an interesting way to convey the information to each other without it being too much exposition. You know what exposition is?
No.
Okay. Exposition is when you state the bleeding obvious when you don't need to. And I'll give you a classic example of exposition from a movie, which was a movie from a Neville Shute book. I can't for the life of me, I've got a senior moment, forgotten what the title is. However, in it, the actor Simon Chilvers, who played in not Inspector Grace, he played...
Oh, he was, yes, the detective.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He played the other inspector. So he was supposed to be a policeman who'd just come back from working in Kenya, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could give you many Australian, I could give you many television examples. However, I want to give you one that had nothing to do with any of my friends. So this person walks into the police station and says, "Ah, Sergeant Fanakapan, how are you finding it back here in Australia after 3 years of serving in Nairobi, where you spent most of your time rounding up people who were poaching elephants?" And that's exposition. That's telling us in the most clumsy way possible stuff which could have been, could have been a scene in the pub where someone said, "Nice to be back. Is it nice to be back?" And he said, it's after bloody years of dealing with poachers, picking up a pickpocket's a change. There are many subtle ways to get exposition through. The way you don't want to get it through is by plonking it on the audience. So we try not to do that. And when we do the scene breakdowns, we say avoid exposition. And I also got to the point of putting either a C or a P in the corner of each scene, saying whether the scene was to be plot driven or whether the scene was to be character driven, just so as they'd know the right thing. Now, that was our week. On Friday afternoon, the scene breakdowns had to be finished. They had to go to the writers. If the writers were interstate, they did not get them until Monday or Tuesday.
Wow.
Now, the writers had 2-4 weeks to write a 1-hour script. Right, 2 weeks. That's all they had to write a script.
Wow.
Which means that any writers that were present in Melbourne would come in and pick up their scene breakdowns. And they would normally, because we would work late on roughly saying, so what's on the agenda for next week before we broke on a Friday night? We never broke early on a Friday night. Most people finish work early on a Friday. We usually work through till about 7:30. So the writers would come in at about 5 o'clock when the scene breakdowns were finished. And many of them would sit and read their scene breakdowns in the offices, so that they knew I was still there and maybe one or two of the other storyliners were still there, and they could come in and say, got a question about this, such and such and such and such. Now, they also got the scene breakdowns from the week before, so that they knew what had happened the week before. So everyone who was on the writer's list continually got the scene breakdown so that they could track the stories and not make huge mistakes. So in the case of Bev Baker, we got back from the first writers, and I can't remember who wrote her first episodes, but even we got feedback from the first...
Ian Smith wrote 472.
Did he? Well, then it was Ian who said, Jesus Christ, she's a bit full on, isn't she? Even the writers were...
Wow.
We don't know about this. I mean, I just created a monster. And she was as big a monster on the page as she turned out to be played on screen. But when people say, why didn't they keep Bev Baker longer? Why did they do this? Why did they kill? She was gone before anyone outside of the production saw her.
So, yeah, that's my question. Going back to that, do you think Prisoner would have been a different show had you all been in the
show? Of course it would.
You know, if you
I'm not sure. I don't know that it would have been a better show. I'd like to think it would be a better show, but there is such a thing as too many cooks.
Yeah.
And when you've got all the cast sitting around a table and all the writers sitting around the table and a lot of egos in play, I mean, you have now what is called the showrunner.
Yes.
And the showrunner has overall say in the show. Now, the showrunner is almost always a writer. They are called a producer on the show now, but they're almost always a writer. In effect, somebody said this to me quite recently. You said to me, in actual fact, you were our first showrunner.
Showrunner.
Because it stopped with me, really. I mean, I would blow my top if somebody came and change the stories on me, or said, oh, I'd rather shoot this here, and when we get on to things like Pacific Drive, I will tell you a few nightmare stories about that.
Yeah.
But really, you have to have one vision for a show, and everyone who works on that show has to share that vision. Yeah. Now, one person has to be in charge of the vision.
Yes.
Now, my vision for Prisoner, it's close to Ian Bradley's vision for Prisoner, nothing like Reg Watson's vision for Prisoner. But once I took over, it had to be my vision because I was the person who was coming up with the stories. So it's no good somebody else saying, oh, yeah, well, okay, it's that story, but I'm going to tell it this way instead.
Yeah.
There has to be one vision and everybody has to follow that vision. And that's why you need someone. But we'd never had that.
Yeah.
We hadn't ever had it. And that's why, and people said, oh, God, Big Ed, she's never even done the job before and she's saying this. That is why when I think it was John McRae who said to me, will you come in-house? Because Dave Worthington was leaving, who was head storyliner, but only got his name listed with everybody else's. John McCrae said, will you come in house and be a storyliner? And I said, no. And he was surprised and said, oh, but, you know, Ian Bradley had called me his gun writer, and I didn't even know what a gun writer was at the time because I didn't know what a gun shearer was.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll come in house if you give me the department. You give me the department, I'll come in house. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you hand it over to me. And I decide what stories we tell and what characters we create. And now that was a colossal nerve on my part. But I already had, I'd been writing the show for 2 years, and I already was deeply in love with the show. I considered it like a child. And I wanted, I had things I wanted to say. I always say that a good writer always has something to say. If you don't have anything to say, shut up. Say nothing. And that's why we get so much badly written stuff, because people have nothing to say.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have something to say, then you can't, you can write some scripts which are more successful than others, but you can't write really terrible, terrible scripts, because you're saying something that's underlying what's there being shot. Wow. There's something more. And in the case of Bev, she had to die because what we were saying was entirely negative. We were saying that all of our people that we knew and loved, Myra, Judy was still there, I think?
I think Judy was running the halfway house at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But Anne Reynolds, could have been Anne Reynolds who was killed by Bev. All of the people that we loved and that we were emotionally invested in, which made us turn that telly on twice a week. Well, it was on anyway, but change the channel because all prisoners coming on.
Yes.
All of those people were at risk from Bev Baker.
So
we couldn't have that.
So do you think if you were there watching, and I'm using Bev as an example because she was only there for 6 episodes. I mean, Maggie Dent. If you were there seeing it, would you have gone, holy fuck, I've got to keep her in longer. She's staying in longer. Whereas you
No, I wouldn't, because I've talked quite a bit, and I think people now understand this whole thing of pulling focus.
Yes.
It was such a powerful character, and there was nothing sympathetic about the character whatsoever. Nothing. At all. So there was nothing we could find as a redeeming feature in her. But she was played so brilliantly that she was compelling. Now, if she'd stayed any longer, she would have pulled focus away. And as I just said, all of our major characters who we were invested in, you've got to have people that you care about. Right. If you don't, why would you bother watching?
Yes.
Now, you don't care about Bev, you cringe and you crawl and you, oh, this woman, what's she going to do? You care about what she's going to do, but you don't care about her.
That's an interesting point you've just brought up, though. I cared about a lot of characters on Prisoner, but I also cared about Mari Winter. Why would I care about her? Because
why you would care about Mari Winter was because you didn't know enough about her to know what made her the way she was. Number one, but also she had normal emotions. She got pissed off at people. She could laugh at some things. She had normal emotions. So you recognize humanity in her.
She was still a bit of a psycho.
But but so are most people. If you scratch the surface, most people put on masks. And that's why there are people who can't deal with me at all. Look, no mask.
Very beautiful.
they're just me. And that's why I was never a good actress. I mean, there are people who said, oh, I thought you were really good in Arcade and blah, 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 blah.
Well, you were good in Arcade. I love
it. Me. I was playing me, basically. Well, no, not really, because she was shy and thing. But most people have masks in real life. And at some time, the mask slips and you see something you didn't know was there. That happened with Red in prisoner. The mask slipped. Then a mask had been so carefully constructed so that she thought she could control everything. But every now and again, it slipped and we thought, ooh, who is that person really? Who is that person under there? With Bev, it wasn't a mask.
It was all there.
She was just a total psychopath. Now, what makes a good villain as opposed to just a baddie is that you have to recognize, as you did with Murray. See, Murray Winter was a baddie, but she wasn't a psychopath, even though she did some things which were pretty crazy. She was not a psychopath. She was a villain rather than a total baddie. And a villain is the antagonist that you have to play against the protagonist. So you, if you're going to have a hero and the hero is going to make a journey, then you've got to have an antagonist throwing things in their path that they've got to overcome. Now, we only had two true psychopaths, and that was Bev and David Bridges.
Who is we're going to talk about next. But just before we do, in that episode, in that period when Maggie Dentz was on, there was Anne Reynolds was talking to Erica Davidson, who was at the running the department at the time.
Yeah.
Whose idea was it to, and we see Erica come back a few times. We see Patsy King come in for a few guest episodes. Whose idea was that? Was she ever going to come back as the head of the department?
No, she was never going to come back as the governor. She had, at that stage, Patsy was, she was, well, she's now in her 90s, I think. So she would have been in her late 50s, going on towards 60. Her husband was older and her husband was sick and her husband needed a lot of looking after. And that's one of the reasons why she didn't ask to be written out. What she asked was for the governor's role to be cut right down so that she didn't have such a workload. She didn't have to be in studio 3-4 days a week.
Did you write now, her? Because her exit, her last episode, like she was just gone. There was no...
He got, I think John got very ill at that stage. And it was like an emergency thing.
She said,
I can't. And so it was like, okay, she's gone. Let's find a reason why she's gone. But we loved her. I mean, everybody loves Patsy. I think Gerda Nicholson was a more rounded actress. But Patsy played Erica absolutely brilliantly. Yeah. You know, that stiff upper lip. Where's your stiff upper lip? Somewhere above my weak, flabby chin. You know, that she played that really, really brilliantly. And we all loved her. And, I mean, I still love her to this day. She's the most wonderful, lovely, lovely lady.
Yes.
But she could not keep that workload up and look after a sick husband.
Okay.
And, you know, she really, that is the other thing. People may think when they see some episodes, oh, but that so-and-so wasn't in that episode, right? 4 episodes a week. I've explained how that works, A and B of each hour. So 4 episodes a week. The contracts were such that, and these are figures just to use as an example. These are not the actual figures. Let's say that a standard equity contract said you got, back 40 years ago, $500 as a lead actor in an episode, right? If you did 4 episodes, you'd be getting $2,000 a week.
Right.
Most people, most characters were, the exception was Bea and Lizzie and Doreen, I think, in the first couple of years. But most characters were only contracted for 2 or 3 episodes per week. Now, this was another thing you had to, when you're trying to do the scene breakdowns and you're trying to create the stories. If it was just creating the stories, that would be one thing, you know, that'd be a full-time job. But you also had to keep track of what characters you were using and say, oh, shit, we've carried this character.
Yeah, that
over
was a question
into...
of mine. How did you keep track of everyone? What was going
Oh, and you know, I never kept notes, and to this day, I don't keep notes.
Really?
I kept it. I could keep, and I think it just means I'm weird. I'm not saying it makes me, well, I suppose it's special, but it's special weird. Someone else said to me, no one else I have ever met can do what you could do. I could keep a 13-week character arc in my head.
Really?
With every story and every character that was going to be in it for 13 weeks.
Wow.
And I don't know how I did that. It is just, like I said in an earlier thing, everybody has a gift.
So you have no notes. It was
no, I didn't make notes. No.
Wow.
That's why I thought I must have somewhere in my archives notes on these things. I don't. No. I have no notes. And that's why I never realized till somebody put a picture of him up that I created Dr. Stephen Edmonds, the psychiatrist who was trying to see how much autosuggestion would work on prisoners. I never realized I created him until I saw a picture of him and I thought, hang on a minute, I created that character. I never realized I couldn't remember who Sonia Stevens was. I had to look her up on the Prisoner Cell Block H fan wiki and then said, oh, yeah, I created that character. I'd totally forgotten because I never made any notes.
Wow. Now, we had Ruth Ballinger on our list, but I would like to save Ruth Ballinger I'd like to dedicate an episode to the terrorist siege, and we'll include her in that, if that's okay.
Okay, that's fine.
Officer
but
David
let's talk about
Bridges.
David Bridges.
Played by David Waters. We see in episode 408 and last seen in episode 417, he was transferred from Woodbridge, and David, who is now a very successful restaurateur in the Blue Mountains, who we do hope to have on here one day.
That would be great. That would be lovely. He was another psychopathic character who did have a rationale for killing people, which was long-term prisoners, how terrible that you've got to be in prison for all your life. I will set you free. Now, the difference between him and Bev is that whereas Bev would just kill randomly anyone who crossed her path if she felt like, oh, yeah, see how they react, David had a purpose, and that's why we called him the Angel of Death. David had a purpose, and that purpose was to set the prisoners free. He genuinely, even though he was complete nutter, he genuinely believed he was doing a good thing. And he had justification for that when we found out that his mother had locked him in a cupboard for, when she went out. And that was actually taken, that backstory was taken from a true story of a woman who was sent to prison for child abuse because she had, and her excuse, and I could feel some sympathy. She had to go to work. She was a single mother. And she had a cupboard under the stairs, and she used to put him in there with a potty and with some food and drink and lock him in so he didn't get into any mischief and leave him there until she got home from work at night.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's inconceivable to us, but people did things like that 40, 50 years ago. So David Bridges was a more sympathetic character, but he was incapable of growth because he had this mission. So all we could do if we kept him was to have him keep killing prisoners. And once again, that left our people who we're emotionally invested in, it left them at risk. Now, we could have got away with that for a while of saying, oh, who's he going to kill next? But Cass was a more important character to us than David Bridges was. So David Bridges came in after Bev, did he?
After Bev, it was before Bev.
It was before Bev, right.
Yeah, Bev was 472 and David was 417.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So We cared about Cass, and I wanted people to care about Cass. I loved Babs McMillan, still do. She played Cass perfectly.
Yeah.
And I wanted us to be more invested in Cass than we were in David Bridges. And so he never really killed anyone. I know that people will tell me I'm wrong and they did care about these people, but David Bridges never really killed anyone we gave a shit about. If he killed Lizzie, we would have been, you know, in real, real trouble.
Yeah.
But he killed short-term prisoners who we could live without. I can't remember their characters' names. You will have figured by now that I remember the characters by the actresses who played them rather than by the character names themselves. Yeah. And that's why when people refer to the actress by the character name, I'm always up in arms saying, well, hang on, it was an actress who played that character. You know, and that's why I don't refer to Myra. I don't refer to Annie Phelan as Annie if I'm talking about the character. I refer to Myra.
Yeah.
But if I'm talking about the performance, I talk about Annie Phelan. And in Cass Parker's case, incidentally, I actually adopted from the local pet shop while we were writing Cass Parker, a little Shih Tzu who latched onto me when I went into the shop and it was in a pen and it cried and cried and cried when I left. And I went back and bought it that same day and called it Cass Barker.
Cass Barker.
Because it was a dog. So, and I had her for 12, 13 years after that little Shih Tzu. But Cass was, well, Babs was not like anyone we'd seen as an actress because she has that kind of strange pop-eyed look about her. And I don't mean that in any detrimental way, but she was interesting to look at physically, and so you thought, oh, I wonder what's going on with her.
Yeah.
I loved her and I loved the character. So when I thought, okay, so, you know, who's David Bridges going to kill next? How long is it going to take him to figure it out? I said long before we knew how he was going to die, Cass needs to kill him, because part of Cass's thing was when she lost her temper, she had superhuman strength. And that was taken from my mad grandmother, by the way, the superhuman strength. And is a case in a lot of, I think I told you the story of how Kate Peterson was inspired to some degree by my grandmother, who did end up in a mental hospital for the last 30 years of her life. And, she did the, there's this clock in my head and it's going tick, 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 tick. But she also was a tiny, tiny woman. She was the size of Sheila Florence, and she actually picked up a huge, one of those huge theatrical trunks that they used to carry the costumes and things overseas in, and threw it down the stairs at my mother and I as we were coming up the stairs. So I knew that the superhuman strength, when you snap, was something that would work. And somebody misled me recently by telling me, well, actually, no, it was the Prisoner Cell Block H wiki page, which told me that she chopped off his head with a machete or something. And I had storylined it that she chopped off his head with a spade. Well, looking again at the...
yeah, I watched it last night, that episode, just to...
It's a spade.
A shovel, like a...
It's a shovel.
Yeah.
It's a gun. It's
very quick.
With a yellow handle, like bunny cells.
It's like a flash. You can hardly see it.
Well, it was a flash because the head was so bad. And, I mean, when we talk, and I'd like to do that fairly soon, because you had a lot of people you asked them too early what do you think were the best and the worst stories, given that it was going to be a long way down the track. But it would be good if we maybe got to that one next,
Yes.
the next one, because that was a story that was not realised properly. And for the sake of a few dollars to get a properly modelled head, we didn't see, if we'd seen that head fly off and the way they do silent witness and everything, and you'd seen blood dripping from the end of it and everything, it would have been a much better story than,
So
and that was what I envisioned. So it
best
was
and
another
bad
story.
storylines is the next one.
Right. Yes. So that was David Bridges. Now, those psychopaths are short-term villains. Right, they are short-termed baddies because of the fact that, again, they can't interact in the way you need them to with the rest of the characters, the people who you are really rooting for and you don't want things to happen to. Then you've got the ones who I call just the villains, the nasties. Mari Winter.
Yeah.
Sonia Stevens. Lou Kelly are Reb to a certain degree. You've got Lurch was not a baddie, truly, because she just was Lou's hanger-on.
Yeah.
And if Lou had decided she was going to become the deacon of the local church the following week, then Lurch would have been there arranging the flowers on the altar because she would have done whatever Lou told her to do. So you have baddies who service the stories for the goodies, and you have baddies who create stories that put everyone at risk, and they are the Bev Bakers and the David Bridges. Now, you'd have to include in the baddies the bad screws, because you have got people like Len Murphy and you've got Jock Stewart, who I had nothing to do with, although I knew Tommy really well. He was before my time. You've got bad screws, people who abuse power.
Yeah.
I never saw Vera as, and I had nothing to do with creating her. And in fact, I don't think it's any kind of a secret. I think it's quite a public thing. So Fiona Spence was Denise Morgan's partner in life. Yeah. And I think Denise drew, in creating Vera, drew on all of the things in Fiona that Fiona never got a chance to play, because Fiona basically was a lovely person, a really lovely person, nothing like Vera Bennett at all. But Vera wasn't callous. Vera wouldn't go out of her way to hurt someone, punish someone. She'd react if someone did something wrong, but she was not a cruel and callous person. That's why I don't put her in the baddie situation.
Yeah, Vera was more like, to me, Vera was like a Catholic school headmistress, she didn't really scare me.
And in point of fact, the Freak was meant to be Vera Mark II, in that originally, as conceived, the Freak would never, ever have been involved in something crooked, in something vicious, in hurting someone innocent. She was an army brat who'd been brought up with strict discipline, had no time for drugs, had no time for stupid bloody women who went on the game, who couldn't get their act together. If they had discipline and they lived their lives properly, they wouldn't wind up in prison. So she had no time for people who were stupid enough to get themselves in prison. And if they broke the rules, bang, they were going to be punished for it. That over the years, the Freak got twisted somehow into this vile, hideous person. And she was going that way when I created the Shane story, and that's when I was trying to pull her back from the brink and say, we need to show a human side of her. Otherwise, we're just going to get swamped by all this, you know, she's hideous. And because Maggie played her so much, like I always think of Cruella de Vil when I think of Maggie playing the freak. I always think of Cruella de Vil in 1001 Dalmatians, selling the puppies and skinning them to make a coat. But, and I wanted her to be more three-dimensional than that. But when you've got people like Mari, Red, Lou, your average run-of-the-mill baddies,
yeah,
and you've probably got more names there to discuss, those people are people who are baddies for self-preservation. They've had something done to them at some time, and they've said, I've got to look after me first. And if that means someone else gets hurt in the process, well, then tough shit. Someone else gets hurt in the process. That doesn't make them 100% baddies. And that's why somebody wrote that, you know, oh, I didn't realize Cora would have liked Mari back in, but would have made her a goodie. I'm not saying I would have made her a goodie. I'm saying that she was a character, and also because the actress was such a great actress, Maggie Miller was such a great actress,
yeah,
that you could round her out,
yeah,
in the same way as we did with Myra as a top dog. You could have rounded Mari Winter out as a top dog and showed, well, she's got a weakness for puppies, or, you know,
yes,
she's got a pet mouse in her cell that she feeds, you know, things like that to show that this is not a person who is entirely bad, but has been made bad by circumstance. I mean, people talk about B as the ultimate top dog, and I'm talking about the character, not the actress, thank you. People talk about B as the ultimate top dog and the ultimate goodie, but B could just as easily have been a villain.
Yeah, definitely.
B could just as easily have been a villain. Circumstance made her commit crimes which she was imprisoned pretty much for life for.
Oh, yeah.
And she could have said, fuck all of you, I'm going to look after me, and I don't care who I hurt in the process. Now, every now and again, B did do that. B reacted against something in a way which you thought, well, that's a little bit over the top, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's because she hadn't been, when she was created, when B was created as a character, there was not enough backstory and there was not enough detail to say, well, is she a goodie or a baddie? So she kind of walked that line
in the middle,
in between, where she could do things which were incredibly selfish for her own, to serve her own interests, and then she could do things which were for the good of the women and were clearly her looking out for others. But had she been better drawn in the first place, it would have been an easier task for the actress to find the nuances,
yep,
in the character.
Definitely.
Without naming the actress, because I'm sick of people saying, oh, we want a 15-round stoush between Cora and Val.
Oh.
I don't want to fight Val. You know, I'm good. She played me brilliantly.
Yeah.
But the character itself was not rounded enough for me to be interested in it once I took over.
Yeah.
She played it, but she gave it everything she'd got. You know, the only argument between B and I, or between Val and I, is the fact that she keeps insisting she was asked multiple times, and I concede she was asked once to come back, but she keeps saying publicly how many times, and the show nearly failed without her. It went on for 390, it went on for as long without her as it had with her.
Yeah,
and my recollection is of being asked repeatedly, write her out, write her out, write her out. Now, we each have our own truths, and those truths don't marry. But there are no absolute truths. But that's the only beef I have with the actress of any kind. Because, you know, part of her playing B was, and of Carol Burns playing Frankie, was why I wanted to write that show in the first place.
Definitely.
And I saw it and said, I want to write that. Jesus, I've never seen anything like it. So, you know, for those people that keep wanting there to be, you know, Val and I going at it hammer and tongs, never going to happen. Have the utmost respect for her. Have a beef with her on this one thing. And I totally understand. And it may well be that her agent kept on telling her they're asking for you to come back again. You know, in which case I have a beef with the agent too, because I was there in the building being said, write her out.
Yeah.
Write her out. You know, I don't know whether Ian Bradley ever admitted to it, but I wrote her out in three scenes, and he kept that in a manila envelope in his desk for the whole time he was the producer. And I wasn't even in-house at the time. He just called me in as a writer and said, this is between you and me. I don't want the rest of the people knowing about it. Write her out. Stick it in a drawer and I can use it if I need to. So, you know, we have different truths. There are no absolute truths.
Yeah.
But the people that we remember as baddies were people who, if they weren't psychopaths, they were people who were serving their own interests. Ruth Ballinger was serving her own interests. Mari Winter was serving her own interests. But she could have made, in the same way that Bea did, she could have made a top dog.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I would have made her a goodie. She would have been sometimes good, sometimes bad.
Yeah.
And Lou Kelly, well, you know the story of Lou. She was in for God knows how long as a non-speaking extra. What a waste of Louise Siverson to make that terrific actress and, I might add, absolutely. Have you interviewed her?
She was amazing.
She's a darling.
She copped some criticism from that interview because we did bring up Wentworth and the Lou Kelly in Wentworth. The fans always ask, what do they think of Wentworth? And it was a question. And Louise said, you know, she created Lou Kelly. And people were like, well, no, you didn't. You know, it was the writer, or, you know, she didn't agree with the character on Wentworth. And, but she did create Lou Kelly in a sense. It was her, you know.
She created Lou. Look, all of the actresses claim they created their characters. All of the writers say, no, you didn't. We did. Because if you don't have a script,
you don't have a character.
What's the actor going to do? If they've got no words to say and they've got no story, what are they going to do? They can't create a character. Because, however, the actor decides how the character is interpreted.
Yes.
So they put the clothes on the naked body, if you like. Now, I have this fight with directors because in movies, etc., directors claim that they are the creators. There is only one creative job in film and television. One true, and that is the person who starts with nothing, blank sheet of paper. That is the storyteller, whether it's the script producer, the story editor, the writer. That is the creator, because they have, before them, nothing exists. Everything else is an interpretation of what exists. So Lou Siverson interpreted the Lou Kelly that existed on the page. However, she has more claim than just about anyone in the show to say, I created that character, and I'll tell you why. Because she came in as a non-speaking extra.
Yeah.
And it was singing her charisma as a non-speaking extra. I mean, I know she was in a couple of times before that, but she wasn't in in the show as Lou Kelly.
Nurse and camera shop.
Absolutely, absolutely. But she regularly was a non-speaking extra. And she created an aura about her, which gave us insight into her personality. So this was a reverse creation, if you like. I watched her on screen and I could never take my eyes off her. She was an extra, but I kept watching her and not the main people in the scene. And when we needed to bring someone in, a baddie, and I said, can that girl, because she was just a girl at the time, I think she was about 20 or something like that.
Nearly 20,
I said, can that girl do lines? Is she? And they said, yeah, she's an actress. And I said, then why the fuck are we wasting her as an NS extra, a non-speaking extra? Let's give her some lines. And I then watched her body language, decided she'd be a smart ass. She'd have a mouth on her. She'd be quick-witted because she had intelligence in her eyes. Yeah. So it was a reverse creation. She created such a strong presence as an extra that she demanded to be created in a certain way. So more than anyone, more than Bea, more than Myra, more than any of those actresses, she can lay claim because they walked into roles that were already created. Her role was created from the presence she presented as an NS extra. I have so much time for her. She's an absolute doll of a person. Whenever I see her, we hug madly. And she's always been very, very... There are a lot of people who prefer to pretend I never existed. So they don't...
Really?
Including the famous one we don't say the name of, who claims, oh, yes, I think she wrote a couple of episodes. I mean, hello?
Did you write the riot episodes for Louise Siverson? Was that you at the time or not?
Was me creating. Not the one in the 600s. No.
Oh no. Okay. I mean, she played that. I mean, I remember watching.
She's
those
brilliant. She was brilliant.
It was amazing.
You know, I could have, in retrospect. And, you know, it's too late in retrospect because we couldn't throw her in the deep end as a major, major character. We just started giving Lou Kelly lines and the character just grew and grew and grew. But in retrospect, if I had known how good she was going to turn out, I can say this now, much as I loved her, there would have been no Annie Phelan and no Myra Desmond. The top dog would have been Lou Kelly. But she would have been a fair but really dangerous top dog because Louise was such a good actress that she would have made. Now, I never saw, I know she did briefly become top dog, and I never saw it, but I would have made, instead of Myra Desmond, it would have been Lou Kelly, and Lou
She's
Kelly
a bad
would have
top
been
dog.
Created. Pardon?
She was a bad top dog. It was all about her.
Well, you can imagine it would be because she'd already established herself as a baddie who was out to look after herself. Yeah. But if I had known in the very beginning when we first started giving Louise lines, giving Lou Kelly lines, how good an actress she was, I would have said, let's not worry about Anne Phelan. Let's...
Really?
Have Lou Kelly.
Wow.
Yeah. I think she could have run that prison forever. She could have been top dog forever.
Wow.
There would have been no reason for Rita Connors. There would have been no reason for Myra. There would have been, but she could not have been the Lou Kelly that she developed into, who was just herself. I mean, people like Mari, Lou, and we all know them. I've worked with quite a few of them, people who are only out for themselves. They don't see the big picture. They're not interested in humanity. They're only interested in Donald Trump would have made a great top dog, except it would, or a great villain rather, but he would have,
He's going to be the first president charged under espionage laws too, I think.
Oh, well, I tell you what, I live for that moment. I'm back watching CNN again just to find out what's going to happen to it.
Now, going back to David Bridges and those storylines that were so powerful, did you ever get mail? Obviously, there was no social media or internet back then. Did you get a lot of mail regarding, you know, you guys went too far with that story, or that's too much, or was there any mail that you would get back in the
day? If we did, we were largely protected from it.
Okay.
Because, number one, it was my deal that I'd tell the stories I wanted to tell.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, some of them were awful. You know, I mean, for God's sake, I'm not the world's greatest genius. I'm not Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci. It's not a masterpiece every time. Sometimes it's an absolute bloody disaster, you know, and I have to live with that, and I own it. I'm not blaming anyone else for it. I blame people only when it's a director who screwed it up. Or just getting back for a moment to how the process worked. Once the scripts came in, because we didn't have the round table read and everything, I never saw the scripts when they came in. I never saw the scripts after they were edited. I had to rely on my conversations with the editors, and the editors would check with me and say, is B meant to come out of this, you know, beaten or more determined or whatever, so they'd know the right attitude to put in. But I never saw the scripts, and so that's why stories so often went awry. And until quite late, I never saw the casting. You know, it was after the Michael Cormack disaster of, which we will talk about in the stories that failed and stories, ones and the bad ones.
So did you when you created a character, did you ever have the character, the actress in mind? Like you said, like, Bev Baker, did you sort of think, yeah, Maggie Dentz would be great for this?
No, I didn't think Maggie Dentz. I didn't think Maggie Dentz, because Maggie Dentz, up until that point, and you were not around, or even you weren't around, and you're an Australian, so the overseas people will not understand this at all. Maggie Dentz was a comedy performer.
Well, Kingswood Country. How good was she in Kingswood Country?
She was great in Kingswood Country, but also long before that, she was the original Mavis Bramston.
Oh, yes.
The Mavis Bramston show.
But she was.
Pardon?
She was in that show.
She was Mavis Bramston herself, who come out of the plane with the big black hat and the black, and she appeared in Comedy Reviews, and I'd seen her in Comedy Reviews over and over again. And at the time, and I think until he's dead, she was married to who I think also played a couple of roles in Prisoner. She was married to Graham Rouse. And Graham Rouse was also a comedy performer. Wow. Now we know, I mean, you see Ryan Gosling in a musical and you're not surprised because you know from reading it online that he went to dancing school for 10 years when he was a kid. So, you know, everyone does everything. But back in those days, you didn't have any access to that kind of research. So I did not know that Maggie was a dramatic actress, and she was just called in to audition for that role. Incidentally, I don't know if you've seen a picture of her recently, but she looks just gorgeous.
Yeah,
got her hair kind of like mine. She's got it swept up at the sides. It's silver. I'm so proud of my silver hair. I worked so hard to get it. I kept saying, please go silver, please go silver. And I love it. But she looks just gorgeous. And she's 80.
She's an amazing actress. I mean, I loved her in Neighbours when she played the school principal, Dorothy Burke. She was great.
Yeah. Yep.
Kingswood Country, which is a...
But you've got to remember, she hadn't done those acting... In point of fact, it was Prisoner that got her to be taken seriously as a serious actress.
Wow.
Because she'd done sitcoms and she'd done stage reviews. She'd done sketch comedy. She had never done a straight acting role. And the fact that she was so convincing and terrifying says wonders about the woman's talent. So if there were letters come in, there were a lot of letters come in about the Joan Ferguson, Terry Knight affair.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there was.
There were a lot of letters about that, and
about
there were
what?
Complaints.
Good or bad?
Bad, you know, showing a lesbian.
Really?
Because I think we actually showed one scene with Joan in bed and Terry in a slip. And so it was very clear that they slept in the same bed. And, you know, that's why I was a gay icon for so bloody long, because I championed those kinds of stories at a time when they were never, ever done. But letters would go to the producers complaining. And because at that stage I was quite important, they didn't have anyone to take over from me, basically. So I was quite important in the continuation of the show. Remember that the show was, I was asked to come in to give it 6 more months. And I was there for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
So they thought if they could get 6 more months, that would be great, which would have taken them up to around episode 340, something like that. And instead they ran till 692. So I made Grundy's an awful lot of money, because it was my doing. I said, if I come in-house, you give me the department. You give me that script department. You let me tell the stories, and you don't, you know, say, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do the other. The only ones that the network ever stepped in was they said, we cannot put, if you go with the broom handle, we cannot put it to air.
I love that storyline. I wish
and it was by far a more appropriate punishment than the Browning was. But hey, that's, you know, it's water under the bridge.
I know.
How are we going?
I've gone over time. Just another thing quickly, those episodes with David Bridges. Now, one thing I want to ask, and I've found this not only in Prisoner but other shows in Australia, Anne Reynolds was on the phone and to her doctor and about the cancer or whatever that was coming back, and they always book something in. It's always the day after tomorrow. It's never tomorrow. It's never on, I'll see you on Friday. They're always making bookings or appointments. It's always the day after tomorrow.
Ask me a trivia question about why is it the day after tomorrow?
Right. Everything in those shows is always the day after
Jesus Christ,
tomorrow.
Matt, you're a smart man, or I wouldn't be wasting my time with you. I can't believe you haven't figured it out. The show was shown on different days wherever it was shown. So they could not say on Wednesday, because the show might be being shown on Wednesday somewhere, in which case she would say, okay, next Wednesday.
Okay, next week. Okay.
So they couldn't say a day. It was always, the day after tomorrow. Oh, in 2 days' time? Yes, that works.
Well, it was never 2 days. It was always the day after tomorrow.
Yes, exactly. Because you never got an appointment for anything the following day, and you didn't have emergency situations like you have now, where you would say, a specialist would say, oh, I've got a vacancy in half an hour, can you get here? It just didn't work that way. People had to make plans, and mostly they went to hospitals, etc., by public transport. You're talking about a time. I mean, now I think there are something like 27 million privately registered vehicles in Australia. Now, there's only 26 million people, which means that every man, woman, and dog and child has a registered vehicle. Back 40 years ago, there was about one registered vehicle to every 5 or 6 people.
Oh, wow.
That's how few there were. So it's not like everybody had a car.
Yes.
People took buses.
Trams.
Or trains or trams.
Yeah. Wow.
And so that's why the appointment was today after the day after tomorrow. Twofold. You didn't know what countries it was going to be shown in, day it was going to be shown. You didn't even know whether, Channel 10 did change days on us several times. You couldn't say the day itself, because you did not know.
the day.
That is why after the first year, I think it was, we never had a Christmas show. After the second year, because we never knew when the episodes were going to be shown. So we never had a Christmas break show because we stopped filming in November. We didn't start refilming until end of February, March. And so we could not have a Christmas show.
Okay, that's why.
Because we wouldn't be on air anywhere near Christmas. But in other countries, it was shown all the way through, and fans in England and China and things like that, right, say, why was there never any Christmas shows? Because we weren't freaking on at Christmas.
Ah, interesting. I like that.
Is that there are... I'm happy to talk about the characters in depth and I love it, but it just amazes me how many actual trivia questions there are that haven't been asked. Like, why do they always say the day after tomorrow? And the fact that 40 years ago, everybody didn't have a car.
Yeah.
And, you know, only I think it was 1 in 3 households owned a car.
Wow. No, I just found it fascinating. It was everything, but not just in Prisoner and, you know, Neighbours and all the other shows. It was always, yeah, we'll see them the day after tomorrow. Oh, she's got her court date the day after tomorrow. And,
the other reason why it might be that way is because an episode might cover 2 or 3 days, in which case you would say, well, why is Anne Reynolds there? Isn't she supposed to be at the hospital today?
Yes, true.
Does that answer that?
Yeah, no answer. So, I know
for this and other totally inconsequential, trivial questions, don't forget to tune in for Matt Makes a Fool of Himself in Front of Coral, episode 5 of Coral's Soapbox.
Episode 5, yes, which will be best and bad.
Best and worst stories. So if you want to reiterate that, because we'll never find it again on your Talking Prisoner page, it might help if people put it on, I don't know what, because they won't have seen this one when we film the next one.
No, I'll find all the questions.
You'll find the page.
Yeah, we're going to take all the questions.
The page, but I can promise you it will include Kate Peterson. It will include Hazel Kent's euthanasia.
Yes.
It will include the dreaded cockroach races. It will include the awful Michael Cormack dressed as a girl so he could be with his girlfriend in prison. It will include the dreadful model head coming off instead of something that looked vaguely like David Bridges. It will include all the best and worst stories. So if you haven't asked one yet, stick it on the comments. But they won't have seen this one. So that isn't going to help, is it?
I'll make a post.
Because this one won't drop for another month or so.
No, we're going to drop the other one this week. But you know that cockroach episode? I know everyone goes, oh, it was shit. It was this, it was that. I actually think it was really good because if you go back to the history of prisons and going back right back when inmates are in solitary confinement. Now, they were in a small cell with not even a seat, just concrete.
Exactly.
The past time, they would rip a button off their shirt, throw it up in the air and try and find it. That was...
Let me tell you, Matt, that part of the Australian ethos back 40 years ago in Outback Australia, and the show was shown in Outback Australia, you had cockroach races, you had snail races, you had frog races. Put all the frogs, empty out a bucket of frogs in the centre with different dots painted on them, and you bet on them and see which frog reached the outside of the circle first. And in America, they did have cockroach races. Prisons did run cockroach races. So I thought our prison was a little bit nice. We had a glee club and we had art classes at one stage and pottery at one stage. And I thought, why don't they do something that's just, which was cockroach races. The problem with it was they got the little tiny German cockroaches and not the great big American 2-inch long flying bastards, which still make me go, shit, even at this stage of my life.
I mean, they race everything. I mean, I was on the phone to, I've got a memorabilia business, and I had to ring a logistics company, and the call center was in the Philippines. This is going back a few months ago. And I'm speaking to this gentleman, a lovely guy, and I could hear all these roosters in the background or whatever they were.
Cockfighting.
I said, are you on a farm? And he goes, no, they're all my roosters in the background. I said, you lay eggs? What do you do? He goes, no, cockfighting. Cockfighting.
Matt, this is not the place for me to give you sex education lessons. But roosters don't lay eggs.
I mean, chickens, you know, whatever they were. So I'm getting over a cold. I've had a cold for the last 2 weeks, but it was just it was interesting. You just,
folks, so Prisma fans, you heard it here first. Matt Batten thinks that roosters lay
not roosters
eggs. We'll see you for episode 5. Anything else you want to add, Matt?
No, that's it. Wrap up. What do you think of ScoMo and his new portfolios?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that. Yeah, look, we haven't got the full story. If, in fact, he had told all those ministers, I'm going to get sworn in as minister too, so that if you get COVID, I can step in, I would have no problem with that. But keeping it secret, I have a big problem, especially since no one has addressed the question of, was he being paid
yes,
extra for those ministries? I want to know that. I want to know what difference did it make. And I got to say that, you know, I didn't think Albanese would be much chop. I think I told you, I always write on my electoral ballots, I reserve the right to consider neither party fit to govern.
Yeah.
And I write that on my thing because, you know, what do you want, cancer or leprosy? Do you want Albanese or ScoMo? You know, maybe it's a choice. They're both deadly. But I think we found a cure for cancer in Albanese. He's doing much better than I thought he would. Exactly. And ScoMo, I'm sorry, mate. You don't. It's like, you know, poor George W. Bush was done the day he was interviewed on the golf course about 9/11. And he went back, he answered the questions and went back to playing his round of golf. He was finished. And ScoMo was finished when he went on holiday to Hawaii when half the bloody country was in flames. Sorry.
Did you see him?
No
in the
time
church?
For the man.
Did you see that video of him in the church not long ago saying don't trust politicians? He was preaching the
don't. Just, well, what about them? What about Hillsong? Yeah. We want to talk about, you know, what about Hillsong and the founders turning out to be, you know, sex abusers? God help us. We couldn't make up stories like that.
That's amazing.
We really couldn't.
I know.
See you next time.
That was episode 4 of Coral's Soapbox. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Share the interviews everywhere you can. And this will also be available across all the podcast platforms, including Apple, Amazon, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and everywhere you get your podcasts from, and the talkingprisoner.com website. See
I'm
you.
I'm going to get my own television series out of this. You know that, don't you?
I hope so. I'll give you a call this week.
Okay. Bye, Matt. Thanks. Yeah.